It's another episode of Walking the Field. Jerry Hopkins, Alex Crow here. We got to get straight into it. We're on Zoom today because Zoom all the way, especially on spring break. Unlike these now four programs that we're going to be mentioning in the final four. Alex, I think I have to ask you a really important question. How has your spring break been?
It has been type unfortunate. I've been working every day. Although a book that I have been waiting to come out has finally come out, but due to all this basketball, all this work, all this podcasting, I have not been able to complete it quite yet, but I plan on doing that at the conclusion of this episode today. But it's going all right. I'm getting that money. You know me.
You already know. Catch them at the Mizzou store basically every day this week if you need to get to, you know, your Mizzou swag on. You know, granted, we might need to get to our swag on for some other schools, including some of these teams that were in the Elite Eight, some that really play with a lot of confidence, even if that caused them to be their demise. The first game I want to go to was a game. Alex, I want you to read the note that I put for our first game today, because I think it would, if you just say that note and don't even say the teams, we might already get it.
That's true, because what the listeners don't always know is that Jerry puts together notes every week for us because I don't prep at all. And his notes are always so funny. And the fact that you guys don't get to see them, a big tragedy. The first line on our thing, it says Elite Eight scores. It has the score of the first game. And it just says, defense. That's all it says. And, of course, we're talking about Houston and the number 12 seed Oregon State Beavers. And this was just one, Jerry, where it was kind of like we thought might happen, where just the superior defensive team in Houston, along with the rebounding, we've said it the last couple of shows, defense and rebounding travel. And Houston, one of the best defensive teams still in the tournament, and they are the best rebounding team, especially on the offensive end, still left in the tournament. And that was really the difference in the ball game.
Absolutely. And one thing I think that was a theme of the Elite Eight was leads. Like, a team that got a lead at all felt that much more important, because there's a lot of comeback efforts, one we're going to talk about later, I think in our last game especially. But, like, you come into the first, at the end of the first half, first of all, Houston only gave up 17 points in a half of college basketball. Granted, Oregon State couldn't hit a shot if you threw, you know, if you gave them the ocean and tried to give them a penny to throw it into. But on the same token, right, to only give up 17 points, but they're up 34-17. That's a huge lead. And when you have to fight back on any lead, it really kills. It killed Arkansas, the game we're going to bring into next. We won't get there just yet. But, like, the fact you have a 17-point deficit to climb before you can even just go up two, right, kills. And Oregon State really did try to do that. They fought their way all the way to a tie game at 55, right? It's 55 apiece, real close. That game got really tight and edgy. And this is where you almost thought, like, this is make or break. But this is where they had to sprint to. You know, it's like if we took it in a 5K, this game, you know, we talk about seasons as marathons, right? Oh, look at the game, and that was like the first mile, all this, you know, corny ways of doing it. Well, let's look at this game as like a 5K then, if we're going to use our bad running analogies. What happened here is Houston started off strong. They ran on a great pace the whole time. You know, they ran a, I don't know what's a good, you know, let's say a 7-minute mile, you know, because I'm out of shape. They ran a 7-minute mile pace the whole time. And what Oregon State tried to do is they ran their first mile really tight, and they were an 8 or 9 minute mile. Their second mile was really fast. They sprinted, they caught up with Houston, but then couldn't hit the gas at the end because they used all that energy. And it's not just physical energy. It's not just the legs, you know, rebounding, jump shots. It's also mental energy to go, yeah, we have momentum. We got it. We got it. But it's also exhausting. You know, it's like, oh, I hit a three, but we're still down 14. And I think that's a huge thing that I want to bring up a lot in this episode, because so many teams that ended up being victorious had a significant lead in certain portions of the game. My final thought, at least, is remember when people were like, Wayne Trinkle might be getting fired at the end of this year. That's funny. That's really funny, because that guy now is, he made the Pac, he was part of this big Pac-12 conspiracy into the Elite Eight at this point. Wayne Trinkle's not going anywhere. What a great job by the Beavers. And again, they almost came back against this Houston team, and they really kind of showed not just the vulnerabilities of Houston, but also that this was a very, very underrated and very good team that was stroking at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much exactly what happened. You talk about that first half, because if you look at just the second half, Oregon State wins this game. You look at only the second half with no knowledge of the first half. You look at the score, and you think Oregon State wins this game easily. I mean, they outscored the Cougs in the second half 44-33, still lose by 6 points. And what happened, there was just a couple things that kept Oregon State from this ball game. And it's something, Jerry, that I think you and I kind of predicted against an elite team like Houston, and a team that was really much like Mizzou at the beginning of the season. A team at Oregon State was hot at the right time. They were definitely punching above their weight class a little bit and playing above their normal ability. You had a couple of factors happening. One, Oregon State could not keep Houston off the glass. In the previous game that Houston had, I'm trying to think of who they played prior to that, and it's not coming to me right now. But in the previous game, nonetheless, they were somewhat kept off the glass in that ball game. Unfortunately, Oregon State was not able to keep – they were not able to keep Houston off just off the boards, period. I mean, they had 19 offensive rebounds. That's even more than their leading 14 rebounds a game that they average in terms of teams that are still in the tournament. And they were still able to, you know, put up those kind of numbers against an Oregon State team that, again, playing well and playing good defense. You also look at just some of the little things. You know, Oregon State, 11 for 20 from the line. Can't have that in a big game like that. They did well on defense. They kept Houston. They held Houston to 32% from the field, 34% from three. Houston did knock down 11 three-pointers. But again, it doesn't really matter if you shoot 32% when you grab 19 offensive boards like that. You can kind of weather that type of storm. And so that was really different to the game. And it was Syracuse was the team that was able to keep Houston off the glass in that one. But Houston just played a great game. And the biggest thing to me was the defense that Dejon Giroux played in this ball game against Oregon State's big man star player, Ethan Thompson. The guard was only 3 for 12 from the field, did not hit a three-pointer, got to the line a couple of times later in the ball game, but he was almost completely neutralized from a scoring standpoint, especially in that first half. Giroux really did a great job of putting the clamps on him. That's why you saw that he was one of the best defenders in the country, and I believe the defensive player of the year in the American Conference. The guy flat out played. The fact that he scored 10 points, almost irrelevant, because the way that he played defense on Ethan Thompson, it's almost like what, you know, the old Cardinals coaches would say about Yadier Molina. You know, they could say that dude could come up to the plate and strike out every single time, and we'd still start him for how good he was behind the plate. That's just about what we saw from Giroux on Houston. And on top of that, he chips in, 10 points, 8 assists, and 8 rebounds to help get the Cougars to a win. It was a great win, and it was just another showing for Houston that shows that even when the shots are not falling, which they weren't against Oregon State, mixed up the defense, played some man and some zone, and the shots were not falling for Houston, especially in the second half. But yeah, you saw that they can weather that storm because they play great defense and they rebound the basketball.
And I really want to hop on that rebounding stat, because I remember I talked to you about how the Oregon State sprints to this tie, right? Here's where the turning point of this comeback changes. It's 55-55. Grant Hunt, Janini Hunt hits a three-pointer, right? Tie game, Oregon State and Houston. Dejon Giroux misses a jumper. What happens? Fabian White Jr., offensive board, kicks it out to Quentin Grimes, 3. 55-58. And then your other point on Oregon State in the free throw line, right? Ethan Thompson misses. It went 1 for 2 on their next possession after he gets a foul, right? And you go 1 for 2 at the free throw line when you're only down 3. It's now 56-58, not 57-58. And this is another important example of this. And we're really the most recent game of the tournament is really going to summarize kind of the same point. But like free throws, small things like that are so huge. One thing I'm very excited about, and we're going to transition this into the next game, Houston hasn't played a team that is not a double-digit seed in the tournament so far. Like, let's look at this, right? They play Cleveland State, 15 seed as a 2 seed. They beat them pretty handily. They go to Rutgers, right? Go against the Scarlet Knights. They give them the best game they probably have of the tournament so far. They're a 10th seed. They win by 3. They run into the infamous Syracuse 11 seed. Take care of that solidly. And then the 12 seed Oregon State Beavers. Now, Houston's going to run into arguably the number 2 seed in the tournament. Well, I think they are the number 2 seed in the tournament. Second best team in the country, I think, at this point, it's fair to say. The Baylor Bears, who took care of the Arkansas Razorbacks 81-72. And remember that lead thing that I said earlier? That was pretty important. Man, did it matter in this game. Baylor came out hot. Like, I think it was 17-4 hot to start this game. And it felt like then it went back and forth. The game we were looking for in this was a very back-and-forth, quick-paced, high-scoring game. 81-72 kind of matched that. The thing was, is the first punch that was thrown was by Baylor, and it was a right hook. that connected. Because, yeah, Arkansas really tried to push it back and forth. It was 10 points, 5 points, 10 points, 3 points. You know, we're getting there back and forth, back and forth. But that first initial lead was so important in dictating that it felt like Baylor didn't have to, you have to worry at some point. It's like, oh, they hit another three. Okay, they're only down. We're only up 7. That's huge, right? Like, yeah, I could say only up 7, but it's not, oh, no, we're only up 2. And I know that seems like a really simple read on this game, but this outside of that early stretch, everything else was pretty even, which I think is both a compliment to Arkansas and Baylor at the same time. These are two very talented teams. One guy that was missing on the floor and maybe could have changed the game, someone we talked a lot about, Moses Moody, did not show up. Man, it was, he was 3 for 11 this game. No, he was 2 for 10. My bad. That was Arkansas's actual shooting percentage from three, which is 3 at 11. But yeah, he goes 2 for 10 from the field, made no threes, but he was 7 for 8 from the free throw line. The final thing that I really took away from this game, Baylor finally shot the three like we're used to. They shot 53.3% from the free from the three-point line. They were 8 for 15. That is something that we were used to with this Baylor team all year, was the ability to knock down threes. And it felt like during the tournament, they were not doing that, but still winning games, which was pretty impressive. They pulled out all the stops which they need to. I think the last time we talked, I was like, I'm not really impressed with Baylor. They haven't shown me what we've seen all year. This could be a huge challenge against Arkansas. They showed it by hitting shots and playing pretty solid defense against one of the better offenses in the country.
Yeah, and so I'll just try and touch on a couple of points that you made just kind of as you made them. The first thing about Moses Moody, guess who was guarding him, all right? It's the guy they call off-night, Davion Mitchell. You want to talk about in terms of one-on-one defense, I'm not sure we've got a better player in the country at guarding the ball, all right? Davion Mitchell does a great job. He doesn't foul all that much. Is, again, on top of that, much like we talked about with Giroux, a competent player on offense, you know, knocked down some shots, led the team in assists with 6, chipped in 12 points as well, and most importantly, held Moses Moody to 2 field goals. And again, Moody, much like Thompson, had some free throws later in the ball game where he just brazenly attacked the basket, took it to the rack hard, and got himself to the free throw line, which is what I think he should have been trying to do all game, because one thing – I would say really the only thing about Baylor is the fact that they do not have great big man play. They were exposed by that just a little bit, especially with having Mark Vidal fouling out. And that one, he's a really big body guard that can shift down and play some extremely small ball posts. But really it was Baylor and Jerry. And we talked about this in the game, or excuse me, in the episode on Monday with Steve, and the fact that this was the perfect game for Baylor, because this allows them to get up and run up and down the floor some, get into a rhythm shooting, and get them locked in for some of these other games. Because sometimes it's hard to establish that rhythm. You play some really slow teams, a Wisconsin, a Villanova, after their first round thrashing of Hartford. You had to play a couple slow games, and this one you got to get your legs under you, run up and down the floor, knock down some shots in transition. Guy who was fantastic on the offensive end was Macy Oteague. He had his best game of the tournament, 22 points, to go along with 5 rebounds and a couple blocks. Guy played great, knocked down big shots consistently. And then we also had Jared Butler starting to shoot the ball a little bit better as well. Again, we've mentioned on Monday that he'd been struggling a little bit. He ends up with 14 points, didn't shoot the ball a whole lot. I mean, he didn't put up a huge volume of shots or 3-pointers, but knocked down 2 out of his 3 threes and all 4 of his free throws. You like to see that from Baylor. But one thing that was huge in this ball game, and I'm not sure if I consider it mismanagement by Musselman, it was just kind of the way that it was going. Again, Baylor got up 46-38 at the half, and then they outscored Arkansas 35-34, just really by keeping Arkansas at arm's length away. They never let them get close. They never let it get too dicey, and just was able to kind of fend them off. Didn't do too much, just did enough to get the win. But one thing that would have really helped Arkansas would have been if JD Notae didn't foul out. He fouled out with like 13 minutes to go in the ball game. Only played 15 minutes and was having a heck of a game. I mean, 5 for 6 from the field, 2 for 2 from three, ended up with 14 points. Only played 15 minutes, led the Razorbacks in scoring. All right, that's a guy that down the stretch they really could have needed, but unfortunately was just too aggressive on the defensive end, picked up some kind of hand check type fouls, and was just not able to play, plain and simple. And that was something I think that was big, because in Moody's absence of scoring, he was the guy who was stepping up. He was the one who was getting them baskets. And really, as far as guys who were shooting outside of the paint, he was really the guy that was knocking down shots for him, and they just weren't able to use him because he fouled out so quickly. And again, you can argue that, oh, why did Musselman have him in with four fouls and 13 minutes left after he just picked up a foul? I'm not sure. I mean, Musselman's a great coach. I'm sure he knew what he was doing and took a risk. And unfortunately, Note, you know, again, not a veteran is JD Note. Or I guess he is a senior, but not a guy who's played a ton of minutes, I guess you could say. He's a veteran by class, but not necessarily by minutes. And you just saw him commit a fifth foul, and it wasn't an egregious foul, but it was – I mean, he hand-checked somebody. I mean, that was his fifth foul. It was a fairly easy call, really, for the referees, and it was one that they couldn't slide. Because a lot of times referees, if they know somebody's got four fouls, it's got to be a pretty substantial foul for them to foul out. Sometimes they'll let them play just a little bit more than they normally would just to try and keep them in the game. But that one, it would happen right in front of the referee. It was very obvious. I think it was off of a rebound, and he just got too aggressive. He goes out of the game, and that was really the difference. I think with him, Arkansas has a chance to bridge this gap. But unfortunately, Baylor, like you said, they shot really hot out of the gate, played good defense. They neutralized the main source of offense being Moses Moody and kept Arkansas out of sync very nicely. This was the Baylor that we saw the first, 17 games of the season. All right, we saw them once again today, and we're going to need to see them again if they're going to want to keep their title hopes alive, because again, they're playing a very tough Houston team in the next round. And I think that we can go ahead and talk about this game because it's going to be a matchup. Again, we talked about how they were able to run up and down the court in this ball game. I think that with this game against Houston, we're going to kind of harken back to the previous two games against Wisconsin and Villanova, where Houston's going to try and get you in a half-court defensive set, and they're just going to try and beat you. Baylor's going to try and do the same thing. I give the offensive advantage to Baylor, but, of course, the rebounding advantage could be huge in favor of Houston, because we mentioned Baylor – doesn't have incredible big man play. They've got decent big man play, and they've got elite guard play. But it's going to be the big men for me, for Baylor, that's going to decide this ball game.
I'm very intrigued by this matchup because, like, one thing I think, like, Baylor has the ability to outshoot a team like Houston, who's very good defensively, but they're going to have to. We've only seen them do it one game this year. And like you said, this is a stylistic clash where you're seeing a team that's going to slow down Baylor. And when they've been slowed down, they haven't been as much hitting threes, because this is a team that's not going to get a lot of twos, layups, and drives. Like you said, Baylor's big man play kind of weak. Houston's big man play is also very good, which also means, like, you might have great guard play, but if you run into a great paint defender, it's going to lead you into different problems. So Baylor's have to win this game from the three-point arc out, and I think the closer they get to the basket, the more risks they're taking. Granted, they can also go and try to run the classic let's follow their big man strategy, but guess who's deeper at big man? Houston, right? So that's something that if I'm Calvin Sampson, who, by the way, won his 1,000th game in Indiana, going to the Final Four, impressive, claps to that, gotta give it a shout out where necessary. And like with Baylor, I'm also really intrigued because if this is the first time Houston's playing a seed that is below a double digit. And I think talent-wise, this is, if not way more talented, but at least more talented than Houston is Baylor. So, like, now we're running into a situation where one thing that helped Houston was the fact that, like, yeah, you're playing teams that are pretty good, but only had, like, one or two guys. But, like, the 3, 4, and 5, you're like, we don't even know them. Could you name me Rutgers' third best scorer right now? I couldn't.
No, I mean, I could name you the top two, maybe. Geo Baker and Ron Harper, but other than that, no.
I'll give you Buddy Boeheim, who's like the second and third best scorer for like Syracuse. And like that's a kind of where you run into this thing. You know, with Baylor, you have multiple guys who can score. And yes, they play great defense, but it's also now going to be, man, they have great offensive players going at them. I like what I saw. Now I'm totally 180ing, right? Because I was like, I don't trust Baylor. I didn't like what I saw, but they finally hit shots. And also, they got back Jerrod Butler hitting those shots. That's also huge, too. Sometimes, you get in those cold slumps, just hitting a three or two, even if it's in a fast-paced game that benefits your style and it's the way you want to play, just seeing the ball go through the net is huge, not just in the game, but in a tournament. And that's a guy who really stepped up when he needed to. You even talked about it our last episode. You said, I'm really watching for Jerrod Butler, and he showed up. So it's tough for me to bet against Baylor because of how offensively talented they are. I think this is the one team that could force Houston, while it's a great defensive team, can kind of break them. kind of like Houston broke Syracuse in that ability when they were throwing lobs against the zone and everything like that. Part of that was because you had the talent on the Houston end for the Cougars to break down the Syracuse zone a bit. I think it's the same way today for Baylor.
Yeah, to me, I mean, this game, it, in my opinion, entirely, like I said, it entirely hinges on the defensive rebounding of the Baylor Bears. You got to neutralize it. Because to me, you know, looking at it, just the stats and stuff, I look at the 30% more or less that they shot in the previous game that Houston did in their last ball game. If they do that against Baylor, they're not going to get it done, because Baylor, again, very rare that Baylor shoots that poorly from the floor. They're going to need to keep and limit Houston to one opportunity per possession. They can't allow them to get two shots, three shots, multiple times, because that is where that 30% doesn't matter. Because if you're shooting 30%, but you're getting easy buckets, you know, you may not be missing shots, they're not falling from the outside, but you're grabbing every other offensive rebound and putting it in. Doesn't matter what your percentage is, you're going to chip into that Baylor lead, and Baylor is not going to rebound like that. Especially on the offensive end. They're a decent offensive rebounding team, but they're not elite. And the guys who are offensive rebounding are not guys who are scoring. You look at, you know, their 11 offensive rebounds, nine of them were grabbed by three players, and they combined for 14 points. So, you know, whereas Houston, they're getting it, they're putting it back up, they're getting it, kicking it out, getting a wide open three. They're going to have to watch that. And so the rebounding for Baylor is going to be huge. I give them the advantage once again, because I think that your point about Houston having to guard more than one player is huge, because it's one of those things where, much like with Davion Mitchell, in my opinion, Dejon Giroux can neutralize one guy, right? You saw it against Buddy Boeheim. You saw it against Ron Harper. You saw it yesterday against even Ethan Thompson, or you saw it on Monday. He can beat one guy. He can't beat five, right? The rest of Houston's team is good on defense, but they're not at that. It's like the rest of Baylor's team is good on defense, but they're not at that level. And so the fact that Baylor's got a lot of guys that can do it. And another X factor, I think, for Baylor is their bench. Their bench can play. They've got three guys off the bench that play big minutes. I mean, you look at the game against Arkansas, there are three guys that they play off the bench. They have an 8-man rotation. All three of those guys off the bench played over 20 minutes. All right. Matthew Meyer, a fiend on defense, makes all the gritty hustle plays. All right. Only had 7 points, but you look at the rest. He had 7 points, 3 steals, 3 rebounds, and an assist. All right. Ball hits the floor, he's going to be first to the floor. Adam Flagler can knock down shots. He's been struggling. I wouldn't say struggling, but he hasn't been scoring to the level that he was maybe pre-COVID. But guy who can knock down shots, especially from the outside in a hurry. Chamwa Chachua, he comes off the bench. He's probably the best big man for Baylor. All right. He's a guy who can stick his nose in, get some rebounds, get some blocks, does a great job of staying out of foul trouble, which could be huge. Those guys, it seems like one of them steps up every game. Sometimes it's, you know, 2 rounds ago it was Meyer. A round ago it was Flagler. They all played pretty well in the last game for Baylor that they had against Arkansas. So it's just going to be who's able to step it up. Macy Oteague played great. Butler is playing much better. And Davion Mitchell, again, doesn't matter if he's not scoring at all, because you know that he's going to be guarding either Giroux or Grimes, and they're probably going to have an off night.
Absolutely. And I think the stat I'm going to be watching for, it's going to be a little bit of a weird one. I'm throwing my soccer roots in here. Time of possession, because you talked a bit about, you know, the second and third chances for Houston. Well, they're not all just immediate layups, right? They're not Andre Drummonding this, which is, let me grab the offensive board, throw it off the backboard, get another offensive board, then maybe put it in to the basket. No, they kick it out. They may reset. They kick out for threes. One thing that's going to help Houston is the more they muck this game up, the more they slow it down, the more they grind the gears to the halt on Baylor's side, and the more time they physically hold the ball can make a difference, especially against a team who likes to play kind of fast, right? So, like, and one thing I think that makes this hard for us to really break down, but one of the reasons I like Baylor is it's easier to speed a team up than to slow them down. But the one way you slow them down is offensive rebounding. And I think the longer Houston has the ball, and this sounds stupid, right? But it really will be that much more important. The longer Houston has the ball physically, whether it's just those rebounds and let's say a putback layup to offensive rebound, kick out, reset your set real quick with 15 seconds or the shortened shot clock. That's huge when you need it, when you have a team that tries to score fast. Because what also can happen in this game, and if this happens, I'll feel great, is Baylor can speed themselves up. And you don't need to when you're a fast team. And I could see them taking bad shots or quick shots because you're down 6 for 3 minutes. Well, we need 3 now. you know, and that's something that kind of maybe happened a little bit in the next game we're going to talk about. Well, actually, the last game we'll talk about, but I'm very intrigued. I had Baylor in this. Alex, give me your final pick and you can transition us into the third game of the Elite Eight.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a stick rolling with the Baylor Bears. I picked them to go to the championship and win the championship. And I like the way that they're playing. Again, you talk about maybe a little bit of recency bias because they played really well against Arkansas, but I like the way they look. I think it's promising. And I think that Baylor can play at either pace with Houston. It's going to come down. If Houston wants to get this upset, they're going to have to play the best defense they've played all year. They're going to have to get at least, if not more, offensive rebounds than they average, which is almost 15, and convert those into points. And they're going to have to take good shots, because I think you're exactly right. I think that this game, if it slows down, I don't say this like, oh, if it's a slow pace, they're definitely going to win. But I think that a slow pace favors Houston more than a fast pace will, right? And so Houston, again, if they have an opportunity to get a rebound and put it back up, or get a rebound and kick to a wide open three with Quentin Grimes, take the shot. But it's got to be a good shot. You can't settle, which is what Houston sometimes does. Why they don't shoot particularly well from the floor is because they settle for a lot of shots, and that's gonna be kind of the theme again. I love Baylor in this one. I think that they're gonna be seeing maybe the team that we're about to talk about right now in the finals here, and we're talking about the Gonzaga Bulldogs, much like we've seen in their first couple of rounds. Another easy dispatching of USC. Gonzaga controlled pretty much throughout. But one thing that's a little bit of an interesting note on Gonzaga, granted, did they kind of call off the dogs, if you will, pun not intended, but whatever, it hit though. They did tie with USC in the second half. The score was tied 36-36 if you just look at the second half. Again, they played some guys, albeit not a whole lot. They only had two guys play more than 10 minutes off of the bench, really rolled with their starters. And that's something that's a little bit concerning to me with Gonzaga. Because again, this game was a 19-point game pretty much the entire time, if not more, right? I mean, they jumped out 49-30 at the half, but still played their starters the entire game. That's a little bit concerning, because the only thing that looks to me is what is going to happen if we see foul trouble. That's the only thing I'm worried about, because you look at the two guys that played off the bench. Both of them are guards, and neither one of them are like a guard that I'm very comfortable with saying, oh, they can flex down to a post, right? That's a little bit concerning. Timmy had four fouls. Didn't matter in this ball game. They wouldn't have needed him to close this out anyway. They were up the entire time. Speaking of Timmy, 23 points. I mean, he's just been killing it down low. You want to talk about a guy who's got a great finesse game, also a good passer, and he's a guy that just finishes. He's a guy that doesn't take the ball up weak, and that's something that I really like. As someone who was not tall and hates when tall people like go weak to the basket and that sort of thing, I like the way Timmy plays. He's got an arsenal of moves that he uses and was able to really get around some great shot blockers, most notably the Mobleys. In fact, USC in that ballgame, we talked about how good they were on defense, especially in terms of blocks. Zero blocks in that ball game against Gonzaga, en route to the Zag shooting 50% from the field. Sounds like I'm being a little bit critical of Gonzaga. They won this ball game easily. It was a smooth 19 points. Again, same as the halftime. They were up 49-30, tied 36-36 in the second half, and won this one 85-66. USC, much like Oregon State, I feel like we're a little bit surprised to be here. If I'm being honest, I didn't think they were going to be here. Jerry, I don't think that you thought they were even going to get this far either. And they were a team that, again, punching above their weight class. They weren't a team that shot the ball very well. Their execution was decent, but they just did not have the firepower. And they fell victim, much like every team that's played Gonzaga, fell victim. And Gonzaga is very good at doing this. They got him into a track meet. And that's not how USC needed to play this game.
Yeah, and the one thing, I think this is the best opportunity at this point in the tournament for a team to catch Gonzaga off guard. And they didn't get close. This is a team that had length, right? A team that could here and there shoot threes. I also had a big man that could knock out your other big man, right? That was one of the few times I feel like if you had, at least when we started this game, you go Evan Mobley, Drew Timmy, you're like, oh, maybe, you know, that could almost be a toss-up. It wasn't. And I'm not as concerned about the second half, partially because that lead thing again, right? Yeah, because that, yeah, you can go, oh, they tied and they didn't have the stars and the depth may not be there, right? But they also have three NBA draft picks playing in that game, every time.
Three lottery picks, possibly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, like those, these are three guys that have a future in the National Basketball Association. And one thing that makes me not as worried is the fact that at any moment, one of those guys can expose a matchup, it feels like. So if Timmy gets in foul trouble, right, like he kind of did in this game, you still have Corey Kispert who can not, is a dead-eye shooter, and you still have Jalen Suggs who can figure out and just plays a really great, paceful game. It never feels like Suggs is in a situation that he's not ready for. And that impresses me so much. I've also been very high on Jalen Suggs. I've probably said his name more times than I, you know, say my sister's name. So I need to be careful here. I've been a little too nice. It's just, I don't know what else the Zags need to do. You know, like, this is a team that has gone past, I think, the regular Gonzaga stereotype, right? Nobody's hung with them. They have so much talent, at least in that starting five. And they always just find a way to be away. This is supposed to be their trap game in the tournament. This is supposed to be the game that normal Gonzaga teams struggle with. And they looked easy. And they got a big lead. You can get on the second half, and it's rightfully so, right? You can say, hey, they still had their starters out, but they didn't play raw. They didn't really play hard. They kind of relaxed on it. And actually, USC tied the second half. They still had a 19-point lead. You know, and that's so important when you get into these games because, yeah, you can eat. Like, they had a subpar second half, and it didn't even matter. It did not matter because they're now in the Final Four without a worry. And I want to bring in this lead conversation one more time. We've talked about Gonzaga enough. There's not much more else I think we need to really say. The other team they're going to be playing, though, has probably had the most interesting tournament and has the most interesting history coming into this tournament. It's the UCLA Bruins, who went out there and knocked off the number one seeded Michigan Wolverines, the Big Ten, which is supposed to be the conference this year, not in the Final Four, something that I didn't even predict. You know, that's been one of the big themes, right? The Pac-12 still finds a way. They had multiple opportunities, and the one team that probably shouldn't have pulled it out did. And they pulled it out ugly. And I'm going to go back to the point I've made so many times this episode because it is so important in this game. Leads, leads, leads. With 18-15 in the second half left to go, the Bruins led 34-25. The score of this game was 51-49. So you might go 34-25. If we looked at that in the Arkansas-Baylor game, you're like, ah, it's just another point in that game. There's still 50-plus points to be added to this game. Nah, UCLA barely put up 20 more. And, man, we got to get this man's name correct. Put some respect on Johnny Juzang. Absolutely killing and doing what he needed to do. He has been the guy for March. He has been, well, I think a lot of people wanted Io DeSumo or Cade Cunningham to be in this tournament. Not that they were disappointing, but this larger-than-life figure where he's coming out there, he's hitting the three. He's staring guys down. He's talking when he needs to. And even got hurt and came back and found a way to win this game. And I'm not just saying him. This is the most Mick Cronin Cincinnati game that we've ever seen. Now, I was thinking about this, Alex. What's so weird about to me about this UCLA team is that it's a very blue collar, you know, and I know I'm going to use all like the white basketball player cliches here. So just give me a minute, right? You know, right. Tough.
Very familiar with them.
Blue collar, you know, gritty. Grimy, gritty. But this is not a team that's really – and that's like anti-UCLA. You know, when you think of UCLA, you're thinking of Flash, you know, these crazy dunks and outstanding threes. No, this team just beats you up, and they beat up Michigan, right? And one thing that I think you're probably going to talk about a bit too, and I want to just make this known, is there was a lot of talk about the end of the game for Michigan between going for some threes, also the last possession where Hunter Dickinson, instead of getting the lob pass, is throwing the pass inbounds. Outside of that last one, there are other situations where they went for threes for the win. I wasn't really against, and I'll explain this. I have in the doc, so you know what I'm going to say, Alex, because I make your life easy, but I don't get mad because these coaches make these decisions all the time, right? And these don't happen. And it's more obvious, right, when it's a 2-point game and you go for the three, but if you're going to make that decision, you then have to set up those players for the best opportunity they can to get at least the best look at the shot you want. So if you want a two, you need to set those guys up or give them the best opportunity to get that two. And he wanted a three. He wanted Franz Wagner to take the three. You know what he was? Franz Wagner was wide open. Juwan Howard cannot control if Franz Wagner airballs. You know, and I think the designs of the plays, the setup and everything else was fine. It was just the execution didn't happen. And That happens. It's happened in this tournament. It happens in rec league basketball. It happens in the NBA. Where it becomes a coach's issue, and where you can say the coach isn't thinking here, is when they go for this play, but then the play breaks down, it doesn't work, and then you put your player in a bad spot. Then that's on you. If you don't have a set that you know is going to work, if you don't put your players in that position, that's now on you as a coach. But they were open. They weren't bad shots. These are not bad threes. The only, maybe I was a little curious on the lob. I thought, like, hey, why don't you just throw it to the biggest guy on the floor, give him a chance to tip it in? That was a little weird to me, but the other two times, those were not bad shots. If they were bad shots, that's on Juwan Howard. They were good shots that weren't hit. I can't say much more that is like, oh my God, Juwan Howard really screwed up the game plan. At least that's my opinion on it.
Here's my take on it, because normally I'm with you 100%. I don't mind if you're down two, you think you got a good three-point shot. I don't mind taking it. I like going for the win, especially in this game where it was clear that UCLA had the best player on the floor, and that's not a risk you want to take in overtime. So I get it. However, there was a couple things I didn't like, and I will put some of this on Juwan Howard and some of it on Franz Wagner. Because you talked about how the air ball, he was wide open. And I'll say something that has been said by probably every middle school coach who's got someone like me on their team who thinks they can shoot some threes. If you're wide open from three, one, might be a reason. Two, go to the basket. You can go to the basket. If there's nobody in front of you, why don't you go to the basket? You're down by two. You only need a two. And you've got a wide open lane to the basket. Second reason, the reason I bring that up is because in terms of guys that actually play for Michigan, all right, with the exception of guys named Hunter Dickinson, and as well as Davis, a guy who played 11 minutes off the bench and is just like Dickinson in the fact that he does not shoot threes at all. Both of them have a 0% percentage from three this season. I'm not sure either one of them has even made an attempt. All right. In terms of everyone else on the squad of Michigan, the other six players, Franz Wagner has the lowest percentage, not even that close. Third thing, Franz Wagner in this ball game, 1 for 10. I don't understand why he's the one that we're drawing these plays for. I look at other guys on the squad. You know, again, Wagner shooting at 34%. The next lowest guy is who? Elijah Brooks at a cool 40%? I'll take those odds, right? You already imagine that UCLA is going to be putting some pressure on Wagner just because Wagner's a guy who can score. Not an amazing shooter, and especially didn't show it in this game, but he's a guy who can get you a bucket. They're not paying, I don't think, as much attention on a guy who again, scored 8 points, but he's a guy who can shoot. I didn't like who was taking the shot. I thought taking the shot, personally, I thought it was fine. I didn't like who took the shot. I didn't think it was a good idea. But going back to Johnny Juzang, you want to talk about the guy who, in my opinion, really, considering what we expected from UCLA, has to be the MVP of the tournament. I mean, this dude has just balled in every single game. The only game in which he did not have like 17 points was a game in which he was in foul trouble the whole game, still had like 13 against Alabama in that overtime victory. UCLA has shown that they can play with a ton of grit. They've played gritty teams. I mean, they played one of the grittiest teams in the tournament in Abilene Christian. If you want to talk about a team that's just going to muddy it up and make the game not fun, Juzang had 27 points against him. He had over 20 against Michigan State, had a cool 17 against UCLA, and then had another 27 against Michigan. Or excuse me, another 28, pardon me. So 20 out of 51 points he was able to score. The man is just on a mission to win. I thought that Michigan's offense did not look good pretty much the entire night, and UCLA did a great job on defense of not letting them get out in the fast break. I'm not sure that they had a single transition bucket. UCLA does that really well, and that's why I think this matchup is so intriguing for Gonzaga. Because you look at Gonzaga, you talk about adjusted tempo, which is Ken Pomeroy's, you know, how many possessions that a team plays in a game, essentially. Gonzaga plays about 74 possessions a game, good enough for sixth in the nation. Sixth fastest tempo in the nation, only five teams ahead of them in that category, and a lot of them much lower on the overall rankings than the Zags. The Zags, of course, according to Ken Pom, number one, but the teams in front of them, just to give you some reference, Coppin State, Eastern Kentucky, South Carolina, the Citadel, and Monmouth, with those teams not being in the tournament and not really even being near the tournament, frankly. Gonzaga, in terms of tempo and good teams, is in a class of their own. You look at the flip side, though. UCLA, however, out of 357 teams that are ranked in this metric, 338, only 64 in the game. They're going to try and play slow. And UCLA, to their credit, is a team that – I mean, they seem incapable of being sped up. We saw it in a game against Abilene Christian, a team that did a really good job in the first game of speeding Texas up, sped them right into over 20 turnovers. They're a team that doesn't get sped up. They're going to play at their deliberate pace. Again, great coaching with Mick Cronin. Again, and they're going to be a hardworking team. They're going to make Gonzaga work for the baskets. This game, I think, comes down to, one, can they keep that pace? Can they keep that pace slow, which I think that they have to try and do to win this ball game. They cannot afford to get into a track meet against Gonzaga. They're going to lose. Any team left in the tournament, Baylor, Houston, and UCLA, you get into a track meet against Gonzaga, unless Gonzaga just doesn't make any shots, they're going to run you out of the gym, period. All right? We've seen it for 30 straight games, right, in which they've just run guys out of the gym. They can score. Lead the country in scoring. They can play. They're going to need to keep this tempo down, and they are going to need to bring their best offensive performance that they've had all season. All right? It cannot be Johnny Juzang scoring over half their points unless he's planning on putting up 50, right? Like, it's going to have to be that kind of game if that's the way it's going to be played. I'm going to be looking at a couple of guys for UCLA to step it up. Tiger Campbell took, in my opinion, a few too many threes in the first half. Not a great three-point shooter. Knocked one of them down, which was nice. He does the best when he just drives in and takes a little mid-range, little step-back fadeaway, makes that shot almost every time. Guy can play. And then, to me, the other X factor in a matchup that I'm very interested in, not sure if they guard each other per se, but I'm looking at Jaime Jaquez and Corey Kispert. Both of those guys, you know, they're kind of on the borderline of being a guard forward. Both big guys can shoot the three a little bit, can score in the post and in the mid-range and that sort of thing. I'm going to be looking at that matchup because Jaquez is going to have to score some points. All right, only had 4 in the game against Michigan. They really did a great job of neutralizing him. He is going to have to show up in a big way. Same thing with Jules Bernard. Jules Bernard in that ballgame, only 2 for 10 against the Wolverines, also had 4 points. You got to get those two guys going. I don't know if they need to get to the free throw line, get the shot falling, because that's a great calibrator, is going to the free throw line, but they're going to have to knock down shots, and they're going to have to play the best game that they've played all season. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to. They're going to need to play the same great defense that turned Michigan over 14 times. They're going to have to get to the free throw line more than the 7 times that they made it to against the Wolverines, and they're going to have to shoot probably close to 50% from the field if they want to keep up with Gonzaga, because you know Gonzaga's going to. All right, even in the game that they nearly lost against BYU, they shot 50% from the field, and that was the only time that I would say this season that Gonzaga has truly been on the ropes, right? BYU had a nice lead. They came back because they got moving a little bit too fast. Gonzaga sped them up. UCLA, not a team I don't think that's going to get super sped up. This is going to be the ultimate battle of tempo. If UCLA can keep this into a low-scoring game, they definitely have a chance to win. But if this game gets into one where Gonzaga scores 80-something points, I'm not sure UCLA can hang with them. And so that is really what it's going to come down to.
It's so hard for me to find a real way for UCLA to actually pull this off. And like, yes, we can go down tempo. Yes, we can have, you know, guys have to show up. My thing is, right, okay, even if they slow down Jalen Suggs, Drew Timmy gets in foul trouble, Corey Kispert misses threes, who's going to get Joel Adai and Andrew Nimhard? Right? Those are two guys we haven't talked about a lot that are so vital, and they've also stepped up in other games this tournament. The Bulldogs, to me, are just – this is – I think there's just a little too much talent for Gonzaga in this game to fail. I like, even if this game gets slow and you have Johnny Juzang doing whatever he can, right, you have all those guys, Bernard and Tiger Campbell, playing their hearts out, right? Like, if you give me a one-on-one between Tiger Campbell and Jalen Suggs, I'm picking Jalen Suggs 10 times out of 10. And that's just the talent gap. Tyre Campbell is one of my favorite players. He takes great charges and actual charges, right? Because that can be controversial. But he takes actual charges. He's a hustle player. He does that great mid-range floater. He does so many great things for the Bruins. And I think the Bruins are going to work this team out. But, like, this Gonzaga team has the ability to beat you inside and out. And it's like you have to pick your poison. And my thing is, like, UCLA can't do that to Gonzaga. UCLA can't make Gonzaga, you know, on the offensive end, try to kill him from one to the other. right? And my question is, who's really stopping Drew Timmy on that team? You know, like, that's what kills me. And the ball movement for Gonzaga is fantastic. They're second, like, I think the second best in the country in assist. Like, wonder what they're going to do. What you can do as like a team with Gonzaga is you can move the ball around and tire some of those guys out. One of the things that made one of the differences in the Michigan UCLA game was that it felt like Michigan was missing their guy, because you talked about, why is Franz Wagner getting those shots at the end of the game? Those shots are made for Isaiah Livers. That's the guy they're missing. And it was apparent. They're not, Gonzaga's not missing anybody. And, but it's also tough for me to be like, Gonzaga's got this in the bag. It's real easy, because this also could be one of those trap moments, right? This is the game again, where you see where historical Gonzaga would struggle, but I am too convinced. It just, it feels like whatever UCLA does a good job of taking away, Gonzaga will just do the other thing. And that has really been the problem, I think, for everybody. I mean, it doesn't matter who's played them, right? USC could have, you thought USC was going to take away the big, you know, the paint. They started scoring in the paint. You know, it's so hard for me to see UCLA doing it. And it's a frustrating thing to say that, because it's like, you want to kind of be like, I wish this game was going to be a little tighter. I wish I could see the way. But Gonzaga's done it all the year. And I'm also kind of tired of the tired take of, well, Gonzaga doesn't, you know, they play in the West Coast. They don't have this and that. Like, what else do they need to do? You know, like, this is a team that very much has the ability to, you know, if they were to win this game and take the national championship, go down as one of the best teams of all time. Especially in a year where things have been weird. It's been absolutely weird, right? You got people popping positive for COVID. A tournament game's gonna be missed. You know what? Like, Wendell, that's one of the first things I'm gonna remember about this NCAA tournament was the fact that that Oregon moved on because somebody popped positive on, I think it was VCU. Yep. Like, that, for a team like this to not lose a game so far, absolutely dominate the offensive side of the ball. And also defensively, they're not bad. I know, like, we don't give them a lot of credit, but it's like, they're long enough. They're not USC long, but like, that also kills. You know, it felt like with that Michigan game, this is where I'm going to make that point with Gonzaga, right? You're missing that one guy to get Michigan over the hump against UCLA, because they made the comeback, right? They're tied. It was back and forth. I think they took a lead at one point, but they never really got to a point where you felt UCLA was out of it, that they'd finally just been pushed out the mud. You know, it always felt like they were in there. Gonzaga feels like the team that could just push them out of the mud. And it's really hard for me to find a way to give UCLA the benefit of the doubt with this team has proven to me every week. I think to so many people, proven every game. Like, again, you talked about the one game there on the ropes. BYU was shooting over 50%. They were shooting out their mind, and it was a tie game. Like, that was the best BYU probably could have played in their lives. People will look back and go, yeah, we had a chance against the Zags. We were shooting the lights out. You know, I was throwing the ball up in the air and it was just going in. Like, that would be like the old man stories they're telling. And it felt like it was like, I didn't even have a sweat. That this team is just so good. And it's so hard for me to quantify that greatness so far, because it's like, I think there's a point, I was listening to a podcast earlier, I forget who, it was with Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic. And the guest, she said, he goes, this was the team that we're wearing Kentucky jerseys right now, like, we just took Drew Timmy, Corey Kespin, Jalen Suggs, we'd be talking about this team like Alabama football. You'd be like, yep, this is John Calipari. You know, and think about Mark Few's done his work too. Mark Few's is a fantastic coach who's made the small school very good. Granted, their tournament resume may not be fantastic, but dude, this is the Cincinnati of college basketball, but just 10 times better, right? Or give me the best overall G5 of football. Like, this is what makes college basketball so great, is you can have a team like Gonzaga come out because you had a coach who could build a team so fantastically, even when they're not having this level of success. Think about how many times Gonzaga's made the tournament and won some games, right? Now this is the one time that there's just too much going for him. I know I've gone on a little rant here, but I cannot truly appreciate, I think it's hard for us to truly appreciate how good Gonzaga's been because of the name in front of it. And I think it's a little frustrating in some degree.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, and like we've established, UCLA is going to have to play their best game all season. They're going to not need to be in foul trouble. And if I'm Mick Cronin in this ball game, again, not that UCLA has incredible depth, You know, they had, in terms of guys coming off the bench, they had one guy that played over 6 minutes, or actually, excuse me, one guy that played over 5 minutes that came off the bench and really played more than 5 minutes just because Cody Riley was in foul trouble and fouled out in that ball game and only played 18 minutes. So you look at that, that's a little bit dangerous and dicey for UCLA. I think they've got some guys off the bench that could play a little bit, especially if they need some firepower. They've got some guys, I think they can shoot the three just a touch off the bench. So it wouldn't be surprising to see them go into a little bit of a rotation, get those guys a few more minutes. But to me, it's like almost, if I'm Mick Cronin, I almost just take the gamble. I almost just say, you know what? We might lose this game. We're expected to lose this game, right? I mean, the spread in this ball game right now is 14 points in favor of Gonzaga, and even 14, according to ESPN. I almost just say, you know what, guys? We're not going to take any threes in this first half, and we're just going to take the ball to the paint so hard, we're going to try and foul these guys out. I think that's what you got to do. I think you've just got to say, you know what? They can't beat us if they're not on the floor, right? Whoever Jalen Suggs is guarding, I'm taking him to the rack every time. I'm clearing everybody out, and we're just going to try and draw a foul and get him out of the game. And the next guy we're going for is we're going to be Kispert, because I think that Timmy's good, but Timmy, much like we've seen with other teams with really good big men, a big man can't beat you by himself. Somebody's got to throw him the ball. Somebody's got to throw him the ball, and somebody's got to guard the guards for the other team. Timmy can't do either one of them, all right? If he could throw himself the ball, he'd be the tournament MVP, no doubt about it. He still might be if Gonzaga wins, all right? He's played a fantastic tournament. I think he scored over 20 points in every single game. The guy is balling. But he can't throw the ball to himself. You get some of those guys in foul trouble, all of a sudden, UCLA, it looks a lot better. You know, if you're not having to play, if you're making some of these guys that don't play a whole lot of ball for Gonzaga come off the bench, all of a sudden, you know, you've got a little bit of a chance. You know, you get just to just pull up some names, some guys who have played in some more games. You know, you make a guy like Aaron Cook beat you. Granted, he's a senior, but he's not a guy that plays a whole lot of minutes. You know, only averages 4.5 points, 14 minutes. You got to make guys like that beat you, to me, if you're UCLA. And I think the best way to get those guys out of the game, and or I guess get them into the game, is to force Gonzaga to foul you. I think, and one guy who I think is very good at doing that is Jaime Jaquez. Jaquez draws fouls really well. He's really good at getting guys in the air and drawing the foul. He is going to need to do that. Again, UCLA is going to need to shoot more than 7 free throws in this ball game to make up for the fact that they do not shoot the ball as well from any place on the court as well as Gonzaga. They're going to have to get to the stripe. Getting to the stripe accomplishes, again, it accomplishes two things. We talked about this when, in the middle of the season, when Mizzou was struggling. And why were they struggling? It's because they were sending teams to the foul line 28 times a game. You know, you can have the best defense in the world, but if you're giving somebody 28 shots at the stripe, you know, if they shoot 75%, that's 21 free points that you're giving up. And so now all of a sudden your great defense is just mediocre because you've had to give up 21 straight points. And then again, if you're going to the free throw line, that means somebody's committing a foul. And, you know, you look at the starting five for Gonzaga, guys that are going to play pretty much the entire game. I like that. If I'm Mick Cronin, I'm saying, you know what, guys, because again, it goes back to the fact that nobody is predicting UCLA to win this game, right? Nobody's saying, oh, I'm very confident in UCLA's ability to beat Gonzaga. And so if they have a bunch of guys in foul trouble in the first half because they tried to take it to the basket and got called for a lot of charges, it's one of those where they might just have to hold that. You know, it's like, hey, we had to make something happen. It just didn't work, right? Nobody's going to look at Mick Cronin if he loses this game and be like, oh man, Mick Cronin, why did you make all these coaching decisions? You could have beaten Gonzaga. Talent-wise, they can't. Right. I mean, again, aside from Johnny Juzang, who is playing like the best player on the floor. I don't know if he is the best player on the floor, but the guy, like I said, guy's balling. All right. 28 points against Michigan when UCLA scored 51. All right. 11 from 19 from the field, got to the stripe more than anyone else on the team combined. I like that. But I mean, UCLA is just going to they're going to have to make this game weird. And I think that's the way that they need to do it.
And that thing about it is like, that's not a horrible strategy, but it's like, man, they could foul out Suggs, but then Corey, like, that's in one, take time, two, energy, and three, say Suggs is in foul trouble, right? Andrew Nimhardt's not a bad guard, right? He's actually shown us that he can shoot and be reliable too, right? Like, it feels like let's say they attack you deep inside and they're really working for those twos, right? Then Corey Kispert hits three threes. You fought your butt off for three layups, right? And you got one foul call. This kid's just knocked down three threes in a row. It's 9-6, right? And that's, you know, that's where this becomes so difficult for me, because it's like, you can make this game so weird, but there's so many different ways that Gonzaga can also just say, okay, you want to do this? Well, let's do this. And not a lot of teams can do that. I can't even do that on a podcast. At certain points, Alex, you just do things, and I'm like, I cannot transition from this. I don't know what to say. Like, it feels like Gonzaga, you could literally throw chairs at them. You could have Bobby Knight come out on that court, throw his chair across half court, and, like, Drew Timmy would rebound it. Like, it's a weirdness. They feel so impenetrable that it almost feels unreal. And I think I'm giving it a little too much credit, but it's also, like, I don't know how to put that in context at times.
You can't give enough credit. I mean, they're 30-0. They're 30-0.
And it's also, like, this is the thing. It's not like their non-conference schedule was bad. I'm going to read you it, right? Okay. They beat Oklahoma, team that was 9th seed in the tournament. Creighton, number 5 seed in the tournament. Beat UCLA before this. Actually, this is all tournament. I forgot. I was looking at the wrong thing. Let me get you right. Kansas, they take down Kansas in tournament. 3 seed. They beat Auburn. Probably would have been in the tournament if Bruce Pearl wasn't with the FBI. West Virginia, beat them. Iowa, beat them. All of this time early in the year. And granted, and this was pre-COVID in the bubble, I think, tournament that they had early in the year. Beat up on Virginia. And what Virginia would do, like, if there was a team that's supposed to, if UCLA is supposed to slow this game down, make it weird, the team that's best in the NCAA landscape of doing that is probably Virginia. And they put 98 on them. You know, and that's a team that's built to be slow, weird, annoying, painful. Alex hates everything I'm saying about Virginia. Like, and that's a team that's supposed to make things hard for this fast-paced, run-and-gun, inside-out offense. They almost dropped 100 on them. That's what makes this so hard for me to comprehend. But, like, will UCLA make this a game? Absolutely. And I just hope, though, that, like, whatever the outcome is, we have to realize that these are two teams that have done a lot. Now, a lot of crazy things, right? UCLA, second first four team to ever make the turn to Final Four. The other one being VCU and Shaka Smart-led team at that point, who's now at Marquette. We'll talk about that more Monday. You know, like, it's weird for me what UCLA's done this year. And I said this earlier, it does not feel like a West Coast, Los Angeles-based team. It's not flashy. It's not fun. It's painful. These UCLA games, the only reason they're fun to watch is because they're close and they just do things where you go, that shouldn't happen. Welcome to March. You know, like, it's not like they're, you know, 360 dunking on people. You don't got Kareem out there. You know, this is not flashy, but it is so annoying that it's fun to watch. And I can only hope that it gets better from there. Alex, do you have any final notes about the Final Four games?
Yeah, I would just say the last note, you know, I talked about earlier, it feels like a long time ago because we talked about this matchup a lot. Probably much more than it warranted because it's very possible that Gonzaga comes out and beats UCLA by 30. Who knows? Talk about how if this game, you know, if Gonzaga scores, you know, 80 or more points, UCLA is probably not going to win. That's only happened 3 times in which they have not hit that number. 2 of those times, though, against the St. Mary's team that plays at a very, very similar pace to UCLA. I like UCLA's offense infinitely better than I like anything about St. Mary's. I think that they are a perennially overrated team. I think they're garbage. And they, again, they lost those games because they couldn't score. All right. One of those games, I think they scored 43 points. All right. Not gonna beat Gonzaga scoring 43. You might beat them scoring 70. It's possible. It's possible. We'll have to leave it at that. You touched on kind of the coaching. Our tentative plan, we'll be back in studio on Monday, 8 o'clock, from 8 to 10, our normal slot time. And what we're planning on doing is talking about the Final Four games, the championship, and then having a little bit of a break, and then starting to talk about coaches in that one. Because I'm not sure. I mean, Jerry, you and I both really like to talk, but I'm not sure if we could stretch, you know, the covering of 2 games and then the pre-gaming of a 3rd game, stretch that into 2 hours. We're good. I'm not sure if that's the route we want to take. So we're going to go ahead and basically split it into 2, have a nice little segment on the games, and then talk more about the coaches here to for our basketball coverage. And so with that, yeah, that's really my final notes. Again, got some great basketball coming on Saturday at 4:15. It's going to be Houston and Baylor. UCLA plays Gonzaga at 7:35. Both of those games going to be on CBS. Also, both of those times, of course, Central Time as we are here. Jerry, you're actually in Central Time too, in Chicago, and me in Columbia. So we're both in Central Time, and it's going to be 2 really fun games. So I'm excited to watch Baylor and Houston square off, 2 Texas teams that I like to follow. And then UCLA, they're going to have their shot at Gonzaga.
I think you meant to say God's time when we were talking about
that's time. That's right. That's right. Amen.
Amen. So we've got two very great games coming to you again. Alex read them off to you beautifully. They're worth watching, I promise. This has been Walking the Field. We'll be back in studio on KCOU 8 to 10 next Monday. Thank you for listening to us talk about the Final Four and so on. And until next time, peace.